Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American women have come a long way in the workplace, and there are big names at the top. At IBM, HP, PepsiCo, Archer, Daniels, Midland, Lockheed Martin, DuPont, all run by women. But overall, despite the long haul from Mad Men days, it is still overwhelmingly men who run the show. 95% of Fortune 500 CEOs, male. Why? My guest today points to what's being called second-generation gender bias. We'll ask just what that means. This hour on Point, Women and Leadership in the American Workplace Today. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Women, men, what do you see? What's the X factor, the Y factor, the headwind now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Deborah Kolb, professor emerita at the School of Management for Simmons College, where she's looked deeply into gender issues in negotiation and leadership. Her big new piece of work, co-authored with Herminia Ibarra and Robin Ely, is looking at what they call second-generation gender bias. It's out in this month's Harvard Business Review. The headline is Women Rising, the Unseen Barriers. Deborah Kolb, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
Gender bias, we've heard of that. We remember it well. We may know it well right now.
Yes.
You talk about second generation gender bias. What is it?
Okay. Well, let me just start by giving you a little bit of history. Mm-hmm. I think you talked about the numbers. You know, they haven't moved all that much. We have a few more women CEOs. 50% of the management and supervisory level in business organizations are women. But there seems to be what we still have is somewhat of a glass ceiling, women not being able to move to the top. And, you know, I think for many years, people believed that there were certain things that would take care of it. Well, the pipeline would take care of it. All we need is more women in those middle roles. Mm-hmm. That didn't seem to work.
Mm-hmm.
Overt discrimination, eliminating that, what's called first-generation gender bias,
okay. That
didn't work. It's worked some. Changing mm-hmm. policies, official policies and practices, offering more workplace flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
We still seem to have these unseen barriers. The next way to look at it is people said, well, you know, the problem is women themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they're not rising to the top is they don't ask. It's a book of a colleague of mine in negotiation, Women Don't Ask. We also learned that nice girls don't get to the corner office. They need to be a little tougher. But then we had bully boards training where people had to take the edge off.
Mm-hmm.
They don't network well. They're not playing golf.
Mm-hmm.
And they opt out of contention, the famous opt-out revolution that women can't have at all. But, you know, those kinds of explanations really don't hold water very well when you start to look at the research. It turns out that when you look at organizations, women do ask a lot. It turns out that they face double binds often when they're trying to be nice and tough at the same time, which I'll talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
They network, but they network in different ways. And the opt-out revolution turns out more that people were being pushed out because they couldn't work out flexible work arrangements that worked for their lives rather than choosing to opt out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for many years we've had this sense that it isn't just a pipeline. It isn't just individuals. We need to look more deeply into the organization and the way it works. So there's been research that many of us have been conducting over the last 15 years in many large organizations, both nationally and internationally.
Mm-hmm.
The term second-generation gender bias was coined by a law school professor named Susan Sturm, and she used it to distinguish it from first-generation gender bias, which is legal. The stuff of lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And second-generation gender bias has us look at the informal policies and practices that look natural and neutral, but they can have differential impacts on men and women. They're not intentional. No one's doing it intentionally. They're not something that men do to women or women do to women. It just arises from the way that we think things are done.
Are you talking now human nature?
No, I don't think it's human nature.
You said natural. Really? I just keep
well,
that
natural,
in my mind.
Natural in the sense of what we take for granted in the way organizations should run. Mm-hmm. You know, as we always like to say, you know, what was the model of organizations as big corporations were growing up? Mm-hmm. The 1950s especially, dominated all by men. Mm-hmm. They were structured to fit the lives of men, wives at home, relocate constantly. Mm-hmm. If you want to move up, take an international assignment, play, get to know people on the golf course, take your wife along with you to the dinners. All those were sort of taken for granted ways that organizations ran. And not all of those obviously still play out exactly in the same way, but many of them do. So in the sense of natural, it seemed like, well, it fits the lives of the people who have dominated in our workplace. And so in that sense, we think that it's natural, not that it's because it's just men. It's just because of the way the organization will run.
So if first generation was sort of you want to change the way the game was played to make it more fair for women, now you're saying change the game itself, the game board itself somehow?
Well, I don't think it's, I think it's changing the game board itself. I think it requires looking at assumptions that we've always made mm-hmm. and thinking about ways we might think about them differently. Let's take the idea of, you know, relocating all the time mm-hmm. as an example.
If you want to climb, be prepared to move to do it. You might have to go out and be in charge of Asian operations for a couple years before you come back to the big chair at home,
exactly.
You name it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's a wonderful example of something that is was based on the idea, the special idea of what a family looks like and people willing
that,
to do
that
it.
You would have a spouse that would come with you
exactly.
And she and that would likely be a she.
That would most likely be a she and mm-hmm. you would take the children, you would do it many, many times.
Okay.
And so if you didn't do that, you were taking yourself out of leadership contention. But when you think about that as having differential impact on men and women, and indeed different groups of men and women, many women were willing to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that women wouldn't have been willing to do that. And many men were not willing to do that, particularly if they had working spouses.
I just don't want to disrupt the family. I'm going to just take a pass on that.
I'm going to take a pass
so
on
that. So it's sorted out for a certain kind of person, often male.
Exactly. And so what we say is if you look at that, you can start to ask the question, is it really in our interconnected world necessary for everybody to take those kind of relocations? Can we re-examine some of these cultural policies, work policies, and see whether, in fact, they're really required?
But let's just take that one. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, of course, you can get on and Skype to Tokyo or China, but we all know there's no substitute for hands-on.
Right, but you don't have to go for full-time. I've worked with a woman who was, she worked for a large oil company. She worked in Ghana. She had an outpost in Ghana.
Yep.
She went for a week, a month, and then came back. It isn't necessarily the case that you have to disrupt the family for 3 years.
So,
you can manage it structurally.
But this gets into real nuances here.
Yes.
And sort of contests, perhaps, of values. I mean, let's say that it was going to make the company, you know, 8% more competitive if the next CEO has the visceral experience of living in a huge market, let's say China.
Do we know
that? Well, let's just posit that.
Right.
But the company would be, you know, only slightly less competitive if the next CEO knew China via some frequent visits and Skyping. Is it worth that change to put women in a more advantaged situation?
I guess I would ask the question, how do you know?
I don't. It's presumptions in the way we've done things.
So one of the things that we talk about is running experiments, trying it on small scales. We call them small wins.
Yeah.
Try it and see whether it actually makes a difference or not. I think many of the assumptions that we use about moving up may be outdated if you start to look at them more deeply.
If men had to make these choices, and some were willing to move all over the place and some weren't, mm-hmm. and that winnowed men out, why not winnow women out in the same way?
Well, but it isn't necessary. They might be winnowing out talent just because they're picking the people who are willing to move.
Yeah.
They might be winnowing out. Sorry, that's winnowing out is complicated.
Yes.
Winnowing out talented men
mm-hmm.
and winnowing out talented women because they're just picking the people who are willing to do something like relocate.
It's not only about relocation. You write about other things here. Leadership styles, what people expect kind of traditionally in the posture of leadership.
Right. So, you know, I think we tend to associate leadership with masculinity.
Mm.
The example I often like to give is Mayor Rudolph Giuliani at 9/11, right? That was the epitome of a take-charge leader. And in our culture, we tend to think that leadership is masculine.
Man on horseback.
Man on horseback, mm-hmm. right? The Marlboro Man, mm-hmm. in some way. A man on horseback who's decisive, assertive, pushes everything
indomitable.
And so, you know, one of the things that's interesting, I think, most of the time, in many articles and research on leadership these days, that style is actually not the one that's highly valued. Mm-hmm. So we often tell men to take the edge off a little bit. For women, that kind of leadership style is complicated. So, you know, it used to be nice girls don't get to the corner office, so don't be nice. So then the work was bully broads, take this off the sharp elbows. Mm-hmm. But what we know is women often face double binds, that if they are seen as nice, they might not be seen as competent. If they're seen as competent, they might not be seen as so nice. When I teach, I use a cartoon that has a king and a queen sitting there, and the queen says, "How come when I have their head cut off, I'm the bitch?" Right?
So and he's the monarch.
And he's the monarch. Mm-hmm. I once did an analysis of 360-degree feedback that women got, the same woman. It was a professional services firm. They got 360-degree feedback, you know, from supervisors, from peers, from subordinates, from bosses. Mm-hmm. And they're, in general, what we know actually in 360 feedback, women actually outperform men traditionally. Mm-hmm. But these women used to get this mixed messages in their feedback. Be decisive, but be more collaborative. Say no more, but be more visible. This kind of mixed messages, I think, is part of some of the double bind that women find themselves in.
It sounds like you're asking not just for change in women, but maybe for the culture around
them.
That's
all I'm talking about.
All we're talking about here is cultural revolution.
It's not cultural revolution. I think as we call it small wins, sort of cultural change, because it's not just about individuals.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about women in the workplace, the glass ceiling, now what's being called second-generation gender bias, and how to tackle it. Here's a little bit from Sheryl Sandberg, Chief Operating Officer at Facebook. She's called attention to this deficit of women at the top in her book, Lean In, got a lot of attention. In June, she talked with CBS 60 Minutes, explained how early on in her career, it was hard for her to balance her skills and ambition with the persona people expected of her as a woman.
My entire life, I have been told, or I have felt, that I should hold back on being too successful, too smart, too, you know, lots of things.
Just too, and now there she is, COO at Facebook. Not too bad. Deborah Kolb is with me in the studio, professor emeritus at the School of Management for Simmons College, and she's co-author of the Harvard Business Review piece, Women Rising, The Unseen Barriers. You can link to that piece at our website, onpointradio.org. It's talking about second-generation gender bias. We talked, Debbie, about relocation, who will do it, who's less likely. We talked about leadership style. What else is on your list of second-generation?
Well, that was Sheryl Sandberg's point, right?
Yes.
It was a double bind.
Two, 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 this or that.
So one of the things that I think we've always find is the idea of people hire like them. Hire like me, we call it. You know, trying to find people who look like you.
Replicate themselves.
Replicate themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get to the senior levels of organizations, it's a very fluid sense of who's going to succeed and who's not. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that people look for people like themselves is not so surprising. In one of the companies we work with, we interviewed somebody, and she said, you know, we've been doing constant reorganizations, and decisions need to be made quickly. So managers are reluctant to take a chance on somebody they don't know well. Mm-hmm. Instead, they hire people they already know, even when it means passing over women who've been doing the job. Mm-hmm. So when you look at hire like me, it runs smack into the idea that we might not be getting the best person for the role.
But they're willing to hire, as you said, 50% of women in management, female.
Right.
You can go pretty high up the pyramid and find pretty rich representation.
Right.
Is that tip top? So,
that's sort of a senior vice president level and above is where I think we have the issues.
But men are willing to hire and rely on women's competence and skills at many levels in organizations.
Right.
Is it just men saying, I don't think she can do it, or I just can't see a woman in that role, or what?
First of all, the story I just told you is about a woman telling the story,
right?
So it's not just men who are doing it. Women do it as well. I think it can be a risk, and I think it's risky in several ways. First of all, senior leaders may not know some of the women they're looking at all that well. Mm-hmm. They may not have sponsored or mentored them in to the same degree that they have men. I once interviewed the CEO of a large professional firm, and he said, you know, when I put a man in a senior leadership role, I know him. I know he's going to succeed. When a woman, I put a woman in that role, I'm not sure. I mean, I have to see how she does.
You mean because of her or because of the chemistry of the organization?
Because
both?
He just had a more of a connection, mm-hmm. more of a network connection.
Yeah.
And we do know that men have more rich networks than women at senior leaders, senior leadership levels.
And they probably sort of know what to expect from another man, maybe more closely.
They might know what to expect more. A woman might be seen as a risk.
Mm.
And she's a risk not just because of who she is.
Yeah.
But because when you have very few women in leadership roles, they're hyper-visible.
Mm-hmm.
People are always watching them and looking. It's very hard sometimes for them to succeed. One of the things we find is in those hyper-visible roles, you can sometimes find women being too controlling, not delegating enough, not because they don't have it in their skill set, but because of the visibility. They're under the microscope. People are watching them.
But the leader's always watched. Why is that harder for a woman?
A leader is always watched. Sometimes the story I just told you about this guy said, I know he's going to succeed. Why
yep.
did he know he's going to succeed? Because he had a network that was going to, someone was going, people were going to have his back.
Okay.
A woman necessarily in that role does not necessarily in those kinds of situations.
Could be set up for a takedown. Debbie Cole, please stand by.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to bring in a couple more interesting voices here in just a moment, but a couple of calls first. Elizabeth is calling from Stratford, Connecticut. Elizabeth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I'm a freelance journalist, and I've been a journalist for 25 years. A lot of the place that I like to engage conversation informally about this particular topic is on Facebook, and I have a lot of friends who are journalists, male, female, and in that workplace, it's a very balanced workplace and has been for a long time.
Okay.
But I would say that it's very interesting to me when you engage this type of conversation about feminist topic. Well, we need something more for moms, or we need something more for the family, and you post an article from the New York Times, or you post a conversation about Sheryl Sandberg on Facebook, you get air silence from the male voices on Facebook. So you get very little feedback from the men engaging in this conversation. Mm-hmm. So earlier when you were talking about mm-hmm. having a cultural change, I think this is something that men are very young, even the most intellectual or the most engaged or interested male parties, they are very, I'm not sure, actually, I don't actually know what, how they're feeling about it, but I do feel like there's a real death grip on keeping things as they are.
I mean, maybe at this point, Elizabeth, with all the progress women have made, you know, they feel the other gender at the gates. Maybe they just don't want to open those gates because there's a lot of competition already.
Perhaps competition, and I think perhaps a real fear of not knowing what's on the other side, especially when you engage the family aspect of it. If I let go of the way my family is made up right now, and the family aspect certainly comes up when you have the conversation with Sheryl Sandberg, and if I say that I'm going to let my wife work, then am I going to have to stay at home? Who's going to take care of our kids? Our culture is not set up in the way that Finland is at this point.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Elizabeth, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Let me take it to Deborah Kolb. I mean, there is a kind of upheaval implicit in this, a kind of change of the order.
Right.
Maybe it's not a surprise that men get sort of silent when the issue comes up.
Well, you know, I think it's a really good point. I think it's the way the issue is framed. I think the way we like to talk about these issues, it's gender, so we're not just talking about men and women. And I think for many people coming up, first of all, around work and personal life, I think we know that sort of younger generation workers, both men and women are very interested in having a full family and a full work life. I know that in one of the surveys that was done recently at Harvard Business School, that's one of the things that came up, that both men and women are really concerned about having full family lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I always like to think this work is what I call the canary in the mine. That is, when you surface some of these issues, it's not just for women, it helps men and women. But I want to say one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Something just came across my desk this morning,
yeah.
And it was about the idea that now women are doing, they're 40% of bylines in journalism are now women.
Okay.
And it came about by something called the Op-Ed Project, which was a project that made editors aware of their selection bias. when they recruited women.
Okay.
And they also trained women to be aware.
To
be aware. Mm-hmm. And so that led to a significant change. Is that bad for men, that they have fewer bylines? Well, maybe, but maybe not. But I think it's a nice example of a small win, right? Both something that women would do and something that this project got the editors to do.
Deborah Cole, please stand by. I want to go to Chicago and Cheryl Francis. Cheryl's co-founder and co-chairwoman of Corporate Leadership Center. It's a partnership between big corporations and academic institutions that looks to advance top corporate leadership and leadership practices. Cheryl Francis, thank you very much for joining us today from Chicago.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be on the show.
You work with a lot of big corporations, maybe to accomplish the kind of thing that Debbie's writing about and talking about. Do you understand what she's writing about with her co-authors when they say second generation gender bias?
So I need to help you understand that one of the programs Corporate Leadership Center runs, which is really very successful, dealing with large organizations like Chevron and Boeing mm-hmm. and Caterpillar and all of their women, is run in association with Debbie Kolb, your guest. She's our academic advisor.
The network is working here. Okay.
Exactly. Okay. And so I'm very familiar with the work of both Debbie and all of her co-authors and very much buy into it. And we think there are a lot of practical things that both women and their organizations can do in order to move the ball forward.
Do corporations tend to say, I mean, this gets raised as an issue, and do they say, yeah, we got to get to work on that, or do they say, hey, you know, we're okay, well, the profits are great, we're all men up here anyway at the top, why should we double the competition to catch you next year, Cheryl?
So along with what I'm doing at Corporate Leadership Center, Tom, you are probably aware I'm on three corporate public company boards, mm-hmm. that of Aon, Morningstar, and HNI. So I can tell you it's a very active topic in the boardroom as well, because everybody's looking for top talent and how do we develop and retain and advance the best talent in the company. And so there's a concern when you invest a lot in, you know, half the population, the 50% of women who are in the managerial ranks and not making it through, there's a big concern about that. And I'd say it's not so much that people aren't interested in the topic, it's that they're trying to figure out what to do because mm-hmm. they've been working on it for 15 to 20 years, as Debbie mentioned at the beginning, around policies and things of that sort. But what we're into these dynamics of subtle business practices and corporate cultural issues that are much harder to address and harder to see. And so they're frustrated, but they're still trying to figure out, you know, what can we do differently in order to succeed?
Let's get some testimony from someone who's been right at the rock face in the mine here. Cheryl, Deborah, please stand by. Amy Anuk joins us from Puerto Vallarta in Mexico today. She's Senior Vice President of Business Development at Encor Capital Group. That's in San Diego, California. She's also chairwoman of a group there called Women at Encor. It's a program to establish to open opportunities for leadership to women. But she's been around this track herself. Amy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
You have talked about how you had to go through a kind of personal, I don't know what the right word is, renaissance, remake, overhaul, in order to shape yourself for a top leadership position at Encor. What was that change you had to go through, Amy?
Sure, Tom. I was lucky enough to go through my own leadership development several years ago. And as I took a deeper look inside kind of what my experiences had been at the company, and as I looked at the top and saw men at the top and kind of created an image of what I thought I needed to exhibit to be successful in my role. I was actually told early on in my career that someone of influence didn't think a woman would be effective in the role. And so as I took that information and many other data points around me and created this persona of someone who I thought would be successful, I actually learned over the course of my own personal journey in leadership development that those characteristics that I had created that were more masculine in nature mm-hmm. were actually backfiring in my own goals to be successful. And as I embraced my own characteristics and the strengths that I exhibited as a leader, I found myself becoming more effective and more authentic in myself. And so it's sort of that experience that I wanted to share with other employees at the company and to be able to give back to those women who may be going through the same sort of experiences, and it's kind of that that goal is how we launched the Women at Encore initiative.
So you first took on a kind of a male style, if that's the right word for it, but you've said that you in that those clothes you got a reputation as too aggressive, too direct, overly assertive, weren't sharing your personal life. It wasn't going down well, though it was your effort to sort of, you know, assume the position and rise. So what was the problem with it, and what did the remake look like?
Yeah, the problem with it, as I learned through feedback within my peer group, feedback from my bosses, feedback from my team members, I was unapproachable. I was unrelatable. I was too driven, too focused on results. I heard things like Ice Princess or a robot who I can't relate to, and she's just focused on the results. And as I, again, as I kind of, the other thing that I did is I never crossed the professional and the personal boundary.
Mm-hmm.
People around me in the office had no idea kind of what I was going through in my personal life. And as I shed that boundary and as I opened up more and as I shared my vulnerabilities and I embraced things like empathy and caring and concern for my coworkers, and as those characteristics came out, I became approachable. I became someone who people could relate with and talk to and learn from. And quite honestly, I excelled in my role once those characteristics came out.
So let me ask you this. You've done really well, and you're in the finance industry, which is incredibly male-dominated at the top. And now you're a senior VP there after this makeover. But what about the next step? I mean, I don't want to get you in trouble here, but you've still got a guy at the top of your company. Does this, remade, more personable, more approachable, more relatable character that you're exercising now, and it sounds like more happily at work, does that line you up to go on up the ladder, or do you now run into this second generation gender bias when it comes to tip-top leadership?
Yeah, sure. Well, the way I'm looking at it, Tom, is I hope that it does line me up to continue to progress in my career, but really I'm embracing an opportunity to help more employees and help more women thrive at the company. And so through the Women at Encore initiative, the three pillars that we're anchored around are not only to better represent and engage with our consumers, who half are female, but also to improve the processes by which we recruit and assess and advance employees and how we make it possible for all of our employees to lead full lives. And so I'm really embracing an opportunity to help create a culture where more women thrive and we create a more diverse leadership team in the hopes of not only improving business results, but improving the livelihood of all of our employees.
You've got Women at Encore going on to help do that. Does your leadership at the company welcome that, or is this like, oh my gosh, here we go?
No, I have the benefit of being within a company that is embracing an opportunity to learn and become more aware, and they are absolutely supportive of the effort.
Lucky you. Cheryl, what does this story tell you?
Well, I think it tells you that there's a lot that the woman herself can do, and Debbie's spoken to that. So being aware of what the issues are allows you to come up with a strategy that's going to be more successful as you try and advance and be productive for yourself and for your company. But I think what it doesn't touch on as well is the company addressing the issues themselves. We see a lot of companies that have vibrant women's programs within them, mm-hmm. but they get stuck because it is a difficult issue. How do you change the culture? And so I could offer three or four ideas that would be, I think, very practical steps that any company could take as they're trying to address this issue.
We've got half a minute before the break, but dive in quick.
Okay, so quickly, I can give you examples later. The first is doing a diagnostic of the cultural assumptions and practices that are getting in the way of women. As Debbie said, women can be the canary in the coal mine. Find mm-hmm. out what's getting in the way. It's not making business better, but it's hurting your employees. Addressing it helps women and men. A second would be to be as objective and transparent as you can be around all your processes of hiring, evaluation, promotion, and
mm-hmm.
assignment,
mm-hmm.
because then you've got a level playing field. More women will get through. Have a learning approach. So people who want to be developed as leaders have to fail early and quickly and learn from the feedback and move on. So think about that as you develop your pipeline of both men and women.
Cheryl,
and
lastly, hold the list. We'll get
okay.
the last one after a break. Amy, I know we have to let you go. We wish you very good luck with your career with Women at Encore, the whole shebang. Thank you for joining us, Amy Anuk.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. talking this hour about women in the workplace, the glass ceiling now, and what's being called second-generation gender bias, how to tackle it, whether you see it, whether you know it very well, how you've dealt with it. Deborah Kolb is with us. She's co-author of a big piece in Harvard Business Review, headlined Women Rising, the Unseen Barriers. There's a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And it's all about this second-generation gender bias. She's with me in the studio. Cheryl Francis is with us from Chicago, co-chairwoman of Corporate Leadership Center out there. She's also a director on any number of corporate boards, right in the middle of this whole conversation with us from Chicago. And Debbie Kolb, I saw you as we were hearing Amy Anouk's story at Encore Capital. Saw you was restlessly listening. What was on your mind as she told that story?
Well, I think Amy's story is a wonderful example of the double bind, right? She talks about, you know, being seen as an ice maiden if she started, ice princess, I think she used the term, if she acted too tough. And then how she sort of found a style that would work for her. You know, she's in a classic double bind. And what's underlying Amy's story about how she got her way out of it was not trying to think, am I going to be the ice princess or am I going to be just people roll over me? She really was focusing on purpose and the purpose of, she said, I was trying to look at how I could be a role model for women, how I could get better business results, how I could lead my team better. Mm-hmm. That kind of purpose, which we write about in the article, really serves as an anchor when you get into the kind of situation that Amy finds herself in, these double binds. I gave some examples earlier about in professional service firms. A lot of these kinds of be this, be that, you can't really come to some middle ground on that. You really have to think about what matters in terms of what's good for me and what's good for my group, what's good for our business. And I think that's an anchor.
Let me ask you about that because, yes, I read that with great interest. You said people become leaders by internalizing a leadership identity and developing a sense of purpose.
Right.
And I guess the idea is here that a lot of women aren't fully doing that.
Well, I don't know whether they're doing that or not. I don't think that the implication in the article is that we're saying they don't. What we are saying is that there's so many programs that tell women, learn how to self-promote, learn how to network, learn how to do this. And it's in the service of just you and how you come across. What we're saying in that article is that's not a way to find your authentic self as a leader. The way to find your authentic self as a leader, which is true for all leaders, the ideas about purpose embeds all leadership work, is to try to focus on what's good for you, your group, your organization.
And presumably the company or the organization.
I mean, the company, the business, and that's what sort of anchors you about who you're going to be. Sometimes you might actually have to be the ice princess, and sometimes you might have to have people roll over you. It depends on the kinds of situations in which you're in. But
are you saying that second generation bias resists purposeful women?
Not at all. Well, I think sometimes, I think Amy was an example of the double bind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we say that second generation gender bias, which comes from our societal view of gender, not just in organizations, that women pay a competence likability trade-off often. That's what the research has shown this over and over again. That's a second generation issue. And navigating that can be tricky. And I think Amy gave a wonderful story about how she navigated that over time using feedback. And I think our idea in our article is about how purpose drives that kind of navigation. For men, assertiveness and likability go together. For women, it can be separate. And that's where the double bind comes from.
In part, though, because of a long cultural tradition.
Because we expect men to be one way and women to be another way.
Cheryl, we got three quarters of the way through your list. You said have good diagnostics about the cultural assumptions. Be objective in evaluating and hiring and promoting. Have a learning approach. Give us a fourth. And then speak to this issue of are we talking about women changing themselves? Or are we talking about further changing the culture? Is there no limit to the cultural change we need? A lot of people feel like they've been through, you know, lots of culture sessions over the last 20, 30 years.
Yes, and the fourth item fits right in that bucket, so that was a good intro. Mm-hmm. And that is that people within the organization, particularly the leadership at the top, should be very focused on self-awareness and other awareness, because we all have implicit biases, every one of us. And in fact, you can go on Harvard's website and do a very quick implicit bias test, and it'll surprise you around a lot of different categories.
Yeah.
Everybody carries that baggage with them, and they're unaware of it because it's buried subconsciously. And the companies that are really looking at both inclusion and the advancement of women, and I'd give high marks to people like EY and Deloitte, are having their management team test their own biases just so you can be aware of them, and then you can address them. So that's very much a part of the culture. It's very much of who we are as people, but you can't change your practice until you understand what your mind frame is, and you have to change that mindset somewhere along the way. So I think, yes, there's more change ahead, but change is good for both women and for organizations. And the good part is, based on all the research findings from Debbie and others, is that we have a much better map of where we can go from here to make progress.
Let's bring a bunch of callers in here. Daniel in Norfolk, Virginia. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. How does it benefit society to put more women in positions of power? Is it just to give everyone a chance at that, or because women will do the job differently because they are women?
Mm-hmm. It's
a woman president, if she's going to be the same as a man, mm-hmm. Why do we want a woman president, for example? If she's just going to behave, maybe we're just trying to be fair, everyone needs to get a chance, or is it because they're going to do the job differently based on being a woman?
Mm-hmm. Let's pick it up. Pick it straight up. And Deborah, I'll bring it first to you. Is it about fairness or performance, outcomes?
I think it's a great question, and it's always asked. I think the issue is we don't know overall whether women will do things differently. I think that there's some evidence that that's the case, and there's also countervailing evidence. I think there's a lot of view in the culture, especially like in financial services firms, we might not have had such a women might be less risk-taking. That might have been different. But from my perspective, there's sort of two reasons. You want diversity of talent. You want diversity of points of view. I think one of the reasons that companies get interested in some of these issues is because, their client or customers, they need to have a diverse leadership in order to speak to those customers. I always like to say, if women are different than men as leaders, it's good to have some of that difference. If they're the same, you're just expanding the talent pool. The issue about a woman president, I think expanding the talent pool, maybe a woman president would be different. I don't really know. But I think the issue is talent, diversity of thought are the primary reasons. I think fairness is a good reason, but I think we've tried to think about fairness in terms of formal policies and practices. I think here we're trying to think about the reason we want more women in leadership is because of the diversity of thought and because we don't want to just draw from 50% of the population for talent.
Cheryl, what do you say to Daniel's question?
Well, I certainly agree with Debbie, but I'd add just one other piece of information. So it doesn't deal with this question of causality. Do women do it differently? Do they do it better? But it deals with a correlation. So there was a big piece of research that has been done and now repeated by the Catalyst Organization that looks at corporations. And they looked at the Fortune 500 and the top quartile in terms of representation of women in senior management roles and the bottom quartile in terms of representation of women in senior management roles. And they found that the top quartile, so where there were more women in senior management, consistently outperformed in terms of returning higher returns to shareholders, mm-hmm, more mm-hmm. economic profit, being more progressive, higher growth, all of those kinds of things. There was a relationship between women being represented and the company doing much, much better, significantly better. We don't know the cause.
Why do you think in finance, we had Amy on, but in finance you've got maybe the lowest representation mm-hmm. of tip-top CEOs. And that is a field in which people are, almost madly attuned to ROI, return on investment. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what it's all mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. How do you read that, Cheryl? Because they want the best return. Or do the guys at the top just believe that there's something about their guyness, another guy's guyness, that's necessary to the rumble, the rumpus, the fight, the competition there?
So I can speak to that on a couple of levels. First of all, I'm a former public company CFO. I was mm-hmm. the CFO of R.R. Donnelly & Sons before we started Corporate Leadership Center. So I spent most of my career in the finance organization, mm-hmm. Dealing with investment bankers and auditors and all of those kinds of folks. And I would say that a lot of it comes back to what Debbie said at the very beginning. It's the hire like me, taking risks, all of that. But there is a place where the clients of these firms can push. As a CFO, I know I always push for a diverse team and female and diversity in the leadership of the people that were showing up and pitching me for business. That's another lever that we have to pull that the financial services industry will listen to. They will listen to their clients, but they've been very slow to move. And a lot of it is these business practice ideas that you have to be available 24/7 that just washes women out of the system.
Debbie, what do you say?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, Cheryl talked about those catalyst studies and their correlational studies. And one of the ways that I like to think about those studies is that organizations that are very well run enable women to be in more senior roles. They actually judge talent better. So it's better for women, it's better for men, and that's why their performance is greater. It's not, I think, since it's a correlational study, you can't say that's because of women. My view is it's these are organizations that enable the best to rise.
Anne in Chicago is calling. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk a little bit. The second-generation bias research has really opened up our conversations with our executives here at my company. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question for both Cheryl and Deb is, for myself as a woman executive who I actually head up talent management and leadership development in my company, what are some small wins I can do to help get more women to leadership and to continue the conversation with both our male and female executives?
Yeah, okay, here's Anne, right from the trenches and well-placed in the trenches. Right. I don't know, here we are, 2013. What are some good small wins to look for right now?
Okay, so I would say there are a few things. If you look at an organization like Anne's, my guess is, I think, you know, the hire like me is important there. And so one of the important things is to review the criteria for roles, the kinds of jobs you're hiring. And one of the organizations that we spoke with, one of the leaders said, you know, we write our job descriptions for senior leaders aspirationally, and what we know is that if somebody doesn't have all the qualifications, it's more likely that a man will put himself forward than a woman. And so what we did was
Whether or not he meets the criteria laid out,
rather than do something and trying to fix the women, what we did was said, let's look at what we realistically need in this role. And then they started to have equal slates. So review criteria, insist on diverse slates, try to focus on more mentorship and sponsorship for women, not mentorship the way Sheryl Sandberg said, where people are thinking like a therapist. I loved her comments about that. Trying to get women on high visibility projects so they come in front of senior leadership. Give them opportunities for development with support. Those are some of the things an individual leader can do. Somebody like Anne, who's in talent management, can sort of start to spread that around for other leaders in her company.
How does somebody like Anne turn around to her colleagues and say, hey, don't look for a macho leader, look for something else? How do you communicate that?
Well, I think actually, you know, I think what they're trying, I don't think people would say, I'm looking for a macho leader.
No,
I
think, but you're kind of writing here that they may automatically.
So she's in talent management. You know, what's the skill sets that we need in this role you're recruiting for?
Mm-hmm.
Let's make sure that it's written in such a way that we attract both men and women to that role. I think in her role in talent development, she's certainly in a position to start to look at some of those things. I don't think people say, I want to hire a macho man. I think they want to say, this man looks like he's got the right skill set.
Yeah.
This woman I'm not sure about. Let's go with the sure thing. Times are tough. Let's go with the sure thing.
Cheryl, what do you say on small wins these days? What looks like the low-hanging fruit to you?
Well, again, remembering where Anne sits in the organization. So she's got a lot of the intake and the development of the talent there. And I agree with everything Debbie said. But a couple of other things. Anything she can do to create this level playing field. So, you know, taking the names and the gender references off of resumes as they come in would be something very simple to do. So to try and make sure that the best person is being selected, despite whatever bias somebody might have in their head when they start to take a look at somebody's background. Reaching out to where you think you're going to get a talent pool that is more diverse. So what we find in a lot of the companies we deal with is that they're looking for engineers and they say, you know, there aren't that many women engineers out there. So what are we going to do about it? Well, if you take an intentional approach to your recruiting and your relationships with universities, you can actually find people of color more represented in some places than others, women more represented. There's all of those kinds of small wins that actually, Anne might have a fair amount of control over to take a step on her own.
Let me go to Jay in Lexington, Massachusetts. Jay, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I think my career has basically followed exactly what you're saying about second-generation bias, particularly on the assertiveness and the likability factors. I know that you've got to calibrate your behavior based on the culture of the workplace and who your boss is. And, I know that unless you know, if your boss is male, like I had recently that was Southern, there was, you know, a real calibration on how your behavior was and getting along. I think it was sort of different. On leaning in, I think also in the culture of the workplace is unless the workplace accepts work-life balance, you can lean in all you want and you're not going to achieve the work-life balance because they'll just continue to prize perhaps your work but not necessarily recognize your need for work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the pieces I have with Sheryl Sandberg, is that it's not really about just leaning in yourself. It has to be whether or not your leaning in is accepted and valued. And lastly, I think sometimes, as much as sometimes male colleagues can be, you know, you have to calibrate your personality that way. But sometimes I find that women can be just as unsupportive, and that is a shock. There are some times that you have terrific mentors, and others who may have devoted their life to their career may not be very supportive of women who are trying to balance family and work. And that was one of the more disappointing things I found in a career path.
Don't presume where your allies will be necessarily or won't be. Jay, I so appreciate your call. That's terrific. Our time grows short here. Here we are with 4 or 5% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women today as we sit here. Look out, Deborah. I don't know if you can look at a cultural pipeline. Do you think that's going to change dramatically in the next decade?
I think these kinds of changes are very slow. I mean, I think you've been talking about cultural changes if it's a big, you know, sort of avalanche of change. I think our
approach is incremental.
I think it's real incremental. And I think things will change. I think because I do think that a lot of the things we talk about, second generation gender bias, affect men as well. And so I think relooking at some of these policies and work practices, I think, are good for everybody. So I think things will change.
Cheryl Francis, put a year on it. When might we see a 50-50 CEO list? Ever? 50 years? 100 years? I don't know. What do you think?
Unfortunately, I think it's going to be at least 25.
Okay. We'll put that on our calendar. We'll check back and see how that's gone in a quarter century. Cheryl Francis at Corporate Leadership Center, thank you so much for joining us from Chicago today. Just great having you, Cheryl.
Thanks, Tom.
And Deborah Kolb, co-author of Women Rising, the Unseen Barriers, in the current issue of Harvard Business Review, Professor Emerita at Simmons College. Debbie, wonderful to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.